This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Here in Wisconsin, we've been watching news of the wildfires in Maui in the aftermath of Hurricane Idalia from a distance. That can make us feel concerned, of course, for the people affected. We might also feel helpless in the face of so much destruction. But there are ways that you can contribute to disaster relief efforts. Our next guest is a disaster relief researcher. She has advice about what we can do as individuals to help affected communities in the aftermath of a catastrophic event. And she'll share her years of research on how we can learn from disasters and prepare as communities for the next one. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been caught in the middle of a disaster, natural or otherwise? What kind of things helped you the most in the hours, days, and months afterwards? Do you contribute to disaster relief efforts? Do you have thoughts or questions about how communities can be ready for the next disaster, whatever it might be? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tricia Wachtendorf is a professor of sociology and director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. Tricia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
First, can we talk a little bit about your work? You actually have gone to places in the aftermath of disasters, trying to figure out what works and what doesn't. Can you talk a little bit about what you're trying to do?
Sure. So our center has been studying disasters for 60 years, and there is a strong research community around this country that is interested not only in the aspects that lead to disaster, but how people respond. How organizations coordinate with each other or some of the challenges associated with that, and things that we can do to recognize that people experience disasters in different ways.
For someone far from the disaster scene, as we've been in Wisconsin with the Maui wildfires, the hurricane in Florida, what are some of the most effective ways to make a contribution to help from afar?
In the disaster research and management communities, there's actually something that we often refer to as the second disaster, the influx of ad hoc goods into a disaster zone. And here's why. Helping a neighbor in a house fire is going to be very different than helping a community impacted by disaster. If my neighbor has a house fire, I might bring over clothes, but I know what sizes they have, and I can take back with me what they don't need. I can ask about their allergies if I'm taking them dinner, and I can ask them what they need right then and give it to them in an hour or in a day. That is strikingly different for a community impacted by disaster. There can be a delay in transportation, difficulty storing goods, and often, unfortunately, what we see is the influx of clothes, goods that are not sorted or damaged. People might get supplies that they needed in the first day or two, but by the time it gets there, it's a week or so later, and it ends up being a huge logistical challenge for them.
So what's my best bet as opposed to, you know, going through my clothes closet and seeing what I can give up or going through the canned food in the pantry? What would be a more effective way to give to help?
It's much more effective to give a cash donation to an organization you trust, either a national organization, or even in looking at some of the community groups that may routinely help in an area. It could be a school, it could be a daycare, it could be a social service organization, a community group. Those kinds of organizations that we look to in our neighborhoods all the time, those are going to struggle when a disaster happens as well. And those are the people who know the residents the best, who can step in and to provide assistance. One thing that we know as well is that it can be a little bit difficult for people to give cash if they're tight on a budget. So one of the interesting cases that we saw after the Haiti earthquake, I came across a parking lot sale by a faith-based organization. They at the time recognized that their parishioners didn't have a lot of cash to give. They were told that giving clothes would be a bad idea after the Haiti earthquake. And so they had a parking lot sale. They took those clothes, they had sold it back to other people in the community. And then rather than pushing those supplies on to a country that wasn't able to accept it or didn't need it at the time or it cost money to send it there, they actually sent them the cash that they earned from that sale. So there's sometimes creative ways that we can recognize it can be difficult to give cash, but at the same time, recognizing the real needs of those impacted communities.
I know sometimes when I've wanted to give after a disaster, there's an urge in my head to say, okay, I want to make sure this money goes to the people who just had that hurricane. I want it earmarked for that and that only. Does that make life difficult for relief organizations if I try to do that?
It actually does, especially when there are several disasters that happen one on top of the other. You might recall back when Hurricane Harvey happened, there were several other hurricanes that occurred later. A lot of people gave after Hurricane Harvey and earmarked those particular donations. But then that makes it difficult for an organization to say, look, we have enough here, but this is a community that really needs help. We can't spend it though. We can't direct those dollars to those in need because someone earmarked it for one particular hurricane and not the other. If it's great if you want to indicate your preference that it goes to disaster relief, but it's really important to give flexibility for those organizations so they can shift gears and respond to people's actual need.
Talking to Tricia Wachtendorf, Professor of Sociology, Director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, talking about how we can best help people who experience disasters far away, how to prepare for disasters in any community as well. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your experiences, whether it's philanthropy to help people after a disaster, whether you've participated in a local effort to be ready for tornadoes, floods, fires, you name it, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tricia, let's talk about preparing communities for potential disasters. What are some of the things that, again, everyday people can get involved in their own community?
Yeah, on the community level, there's often a community emergency response team that operates out of your local or your state emergency management agency. Those are great ways to get involved before a disaster strikes, consider the kinds of skills that you might have, and really get integrated into that network. If a disaster happens, there are volunteer organizations active in disasters that have a seat at the table in emergency operation centers. Sometimes those are good organizations to reach out to. If we are in our own community, that is a situation where we often know those needs better than anyone. One of the things that we know as well, that you're more likely to be saved after an earthquake by your neighbors, by your family and friends who know you're in a building, compared to someone coming from a great deal distance away. That holds true on all fronts. We have skills that we have resources that we might not think of as being important in a disaster response. We did some work looking at the boat evacuation after 9/11. And there were tugboat operators, ferry boat operators who came in, who saw a need, who had a vessel and were able to evacuate by people by boat where there was no plan in place. We see the same thing with the Cajun Navy time and time again. So thinking about the skills that you have, the connections that you have in your neighborhood and ways that you can tie into those organizations that are helping so that you can get the information about where those needs are.
I wonder, those boat rescues were great things. I wonder about, you know, the temptation like, oh, I want to rush in and help people. Well, if I don't have skills, if I don't know what I'm doing, am I just making the situation worse? How do people self-evaluate in that way, whether to stay away and that's going to help more or I can actually help here?
You're absolutely right that there's a tough balance to strike. It is best when we are acting in some capacity where we have skills. You certainly wouldn't want me taking a boat out to save anyone because I would just get my own self in trouble. But at the same time, if I am operating in areas that I have skills in, if I'm an educator and I'm used to working with small children, who better to potentially volunteer at a shelter to provide some assistance? Again, that is where some of those organizations that coordinate volunteers, those volunteer organizations active in disasters is really important. And especially if you're coming to an area that you're not from, there are going to be aspects of the culture. Disasters can change the geography, the way you get around. So if you are just converging on an area and you're unfamiliar with it, and you don't have a connection to help you get integrated, that can pose a lot of challenges.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Wazika. Chris, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, we've had two disasters that have happened here locally. In 2013 and 2019, we had flooding that was quite severe, and I helped out with that. I think we ended up with 5.5 feet of water in our basement in 2013. And then I've been active in Civil Air Patrol. I'm retired now. But we did air, ground, search and rescue, disaster relief. Looking for missing persons, stuff like that. And I did that for 25 years.
Wow. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that experience and for all the work you've done. Tricia, what are some of the contacts we can make, the connections we can make now before a disaster? We might not all be in Civil Air Patrol, but so we can contribute like Chris did when the need arises.
Well, again, some of the connections are through CERT teams. As Chris mentioned, as being retired in a certain capacity, there are sometimes organizations like the Medical Reserve Corps that takes in volunteers with a medical background. There's other ones as well, where if you have a skill, they'll really match you around a particular area of expertise. Building those connections in our community. So I'm not sure if Chris's contacts know the wonderful expertise brought to the table, but knowing somebody who knows someone else can be really essential. It might be knowing somebody who has a generator and you didn't know that, but your friend does, or somebody you serve on a community group or your kid's little league team remembers you saying something. Building those connections is really valuable.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. We're talking to Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology, director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. She's here to tell us how we can help communities affected by disaster, how we can prepare for the worst in our own neighborhoods. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a plan in place for when disaster comes? Are you or have you been a volunteer on some kind of disaster response team? What questions do you have for our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology, director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware, talking to her about disaster response, how we can contribute as individuals, how to prepare for future disasters. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest, 800-642-1234. Tricia, before we go back to our callers, wanted to bring up the issue of communication. There are always questions about, you know, how local governments and others can communicate risk to the public and when the public should sit up and take notice and say, oh yeah, I'm the public. I should be listening to this message. What do we know about what works best?
One of the key things to keep in mind for communities is to use multiple ways of reaching the public. Some of us are active on social media, but is that social media Facebook or is it Instagram or is it TikTok? Some of us are more likely to get our information from radio or television or print news. And then there's others who are really relying on, let's say, leaders in their faith community or community groups or government officials. So using a multi-prong approach is important, and making sure that that information is consistent so that someone isn't hearing one thing from one person and then reading something else that is different. That consistency, being specific, being clear about what people should do, those are key aspects in communication.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Austin is with us in Lafarge. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I just wanted to share a great avenue for people that are maybe a little nerdy or like to practice with electronics and technology, that amateur radio, ham radio, is a great skill to acquire and get involved with your local clubs and local disaster relief groups. it's well documented during Hurricane Katrina, 9/11, and dozens of cases of ham radio being the backbone of critical communication infrastructure. And it's a great hobby otherwise, when you're not participating in things like that. So it's a sort of a dying hobby, but would certainly be a great way for young people to practice their science and technology, and also learn a neat way to be involved in times like that.
Austin, thanks a lot for the suggestion. That's not my particular brand of nerdery, but my dad and my younger brother were big into ham radio for a while. And Trisha, I think about that and I worry about the decline of amateur radio, because sometimes if the internet is down, if our power is down, that is a way for people to communicate across long distances.
Yeah, and I don't, and I don't have one either. But I think your caller makes a really good point about helping doesn't necessarily mean being on the ground where a disaster happens, that there are ways to get involved and provide assistance, be it through ham radio operation, which he's absolutely right, can play a really important role in disaster response and communication. By actually setting up a communication system through various social media, or setting up a website for an organization. There's lots of remote activity that can actually be much more helpful to those on the ground than joining them in person.
Austin, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Trisha, that reminds me of the risk of social media misinformation about disasters. I think there have always been false rumors that follow any major disaster. They are super in your face on social media. Pictures that are not accurate representations of what's going on, rumors of disease outbreaks, things like that. How big a problem is bad information spreading about any particular disaster?
It is a challenge. It primarily we see a lot of it in not the immediate time period, but you know, a couple of hours or a couple of days or weeks out. What can also happen is information that was correct at some time for some disaster gets recycled for another disaster. So the image that you see might actually be from a hurricane, but it's from a hurricane from 3 years ago, or a situation that emerged is not from this event in this area, but it's from something else. Sometimes that is misinformation, someone trying to cause trouble. But a lot of times it's also this idea of disinformation that you talk about, where people are well-intended. They're trying to share information. They haven't checked the source of it. And it can lead to real challenges in people trying to make sense about what to do next. Making sure that if you are sharing information that you've checked it before you do that is really important to help others.
Let's go back to our callers. Vivian is with us in Green Bay. Vivian, hi.
Hi. I've been involved in some minor disasters, but the commonality was that folks were looking for someone to lead. They didn't know what to do. Time passed. One was a medical situation, fortunately not deadly. But minutes passed. No one seemed to take hold and coalesce the group. So I think volunteers with some knowledge can fill that role unexpectedly anywhere.
Vivian, thanks for the call. Trisha, are there ways we can be prepared to step up and help out and bring people together in that way?
I think that part of it is this combination of people who are experienced in disasters or experienced in the area that they're working with, working alongside people who might be engaging in a degree of surge capacity, trying to, they don't know what to do, but they have something that they can offer in that moment. So this combination of recognizing where your skills are and being willing to step up to share that with others. Sometimes the person who knows the most is kind of unassuming. In a disaster, someone might show up in their sweatpants and a t-shirt. They're not necessarily uniformed or looking like a leader, but to understand and really keep an open mind that some of those individuals might bring a wealth of expertise to that response.
Thanks for that call, Vivian. Tricia, one thing I wanted to get into in your research, you talk about social vulnerability as a factor in how people are affected by disasters. How does that work? It may seem obvious, but who is more vulnerable? How can we help deal with that vulnerability?
Sometimes when a disaster happens, we have this assumption that the hurricane or the tornado or the earthquake or the environmental spill doesn't care about our demographics, doesn't care about who we are. And that might be the case, but the community that we live in, the sort of vulnerabilities that we have, do make a huge difference in how we experience that particular disaster event. If my power goes out for a week, I might lose the goods in my fridge. I might be eating a lot of ice cream with my kids just in the hours afterwards. But in general, I'm going to be okay. That is a very different circumstance if I rely on refrigerated medication, if I'm in an electric wheelchair, if I'm on dialysis and need to get into an appointment, if I'm in a bed that requires assistance for me to raise it and lower it to get out of bed, that won't be possible if the power goes out. Thinking about how also that vulnerability changes over time as we engage in preparedness for our own household. Was there a new baby in the home? That's going to make a difference about what kind of supplies that you need to have together in order to take care of this new member of your household. Do you provide assistance to an elderly parent who lives across town? Is somebody else relying on you? Even thinking about our pets, we might have a carrier where we're able to take one dog at a time to the vet. But if we have to evacuate, like we saw in Maui, very suddenly, very quickly, are we able to get all of our pets out at the same time and transport them? So understanding how our vulnerability, our challenges routinely become exacerbated, get worse in a disaster, will help us understand how we can prepare our own homes.
Tricia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Tricia Wachtendorf, professor of sociology and director of the Disaster Research Center at the University of Delaware. We talked to her about disaster relief, recovery, and preparedness. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, there have been heat waves across the U.S. this summer, but there's also a growing problem in the oceans. Check out Marine Ecosystems and More tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Driving back across the western part of the state on Labor Day, I saw some of the earliest hints of leaves changing colors, just here and there at this point. That was just enough to remind me it's the time of year to check out the fall color forecasts, and I'm not alone on that. At the national level, the Smoky Mountain National Park website has its fall foliage prediction map online covering the whole country. You can fast forward through the coming weeks to see what should be in the store for your travels around the U.S. No surprise, minimal color so far, mostly in the northern part of the country. By the way, this year they're looking for your observations. You can submit your fall color sightings. Here in Wisconsin, you can make fall color travel plans with the Fall Color Report at travelwisconsin.com. They show the latest reports and the estimated peak time to see the best colors in counties and communities around the state. Where do you go for fall colors? Across the country or in your own community? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out why Wisconsin has one of the highest rates of binge drinking in the country and what that means for our health. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a cultural festival taking place this weekend.
The pandemic brought many annual festivals to a halt. This summer, some are finally making their comeback, like Greek Fest Plus in Madison. To celebrate its long-awaited return, we revisit this story from 2019, when Carol Griskovich talked with organizers from Assumption Greek Orthodox Church about the history of the festival.
It's my understanding that still, and I was digging into this, that we are the longest running ethnic festival in Madison. It's a Greek Fest Plus because we want to really honor all of the diverse ethnicities in our community. But it's really a reunion. It's a block party. It's a community event. And especially last year, people would come up to me and say they've never felt more welcome at a festival in Madison as they have at Greek Fest.
For many years, this was the only Eastern Christian church in this part of Wisconsin. And so as a consequence, all the Orthodox people from all over the world who lived in central and southern Wisconsin came here to this church, and they still do.
Renato, Jason, happy birthday to your father.
Oh yeah, I didn't even say that.
Well, the church was started, it was incorporated with the state of Wisconsin in 1951, and it was a group of primarily Greek immigrants that relocated here in the Madison area that began the church.
My grandfather came at age 16 with some male relatives, and they began working on the railroad. They settled in Madison and opened up a restaurant, the Coney Island. First, it was located, I believe, on the 700 block of State Street, and then later it moved to the 300 block of State Street.
Oh, should we just get like a variety pack?
Hi. Can I have 4 baklava, please?
And we brought back this year the traditional Coney dog, Coney Island dog, which is how so many of the Greek immigrants made their living coming to America. And they brought with them the secret, the spices and the cumin and the cinnamon and to add to this puree sauce that gets spooned over a hot dog.
I'm going to leave one spice out, just so no one knows. We've got cayenne, cloves, cinnamon, of course, oregano, of course, paprika, allspice, and a mystery spice. Garlic powder, onion powder, butter. Actually, butter is what caught me off guard with the recipe. It's like it's going to give it a really kind of a thick richness. We're going to cook it down so it's thick. We're going to puree it, so it's not chili sauce. This is Coney sauce. It's very specific to Greek immigrants.
Have you sampled the Coney sauce that we are using during Greek Fest? Because from what I have been told, we're using your father's recipe.
I have not, because I have never been fond. Isn't that terrible? Our bread and butter, and I was never fond of the chili sauce.
That's who we are as the church, who we are as Orthodox Christians. That familial bond that we already have through our worship is just transferred out into the celebration of our ethnic heritage and bringing of all of these people together. 2 days of this huge festival that just brings our excitement for one another out.
That was Georgiana Wilton, David Giffey, Patty Notes, and Father Michael Vanderhoof, who passed away in 2020. Music by Rithmos and Sergei Belkin. That story on Greek Fest Plus came to us from Carol Griskovich, who is also a member of Assumption Greek Orthodox Church. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Greek Fest Plus will take place in Madison September 9th and 10th. Now, Wisconsin is an outlier when it comes to alcohol, with higher rates of drinking and of binge drinking than the country as a whole. During the pandemic, alcohol-related deaths spiked here in Wisconsin, as they did around the country. But even before the pandemic, Wisconsin had a long-running upward trend in deaths caused by alcohol, almost tripling the rate from roughly 7 per 100,000 people in 1999 to 19 by 2020. Federal surveys have also consistently found that Wisconsinites are among the least likely to consider binge drinking a risky behavior. Our next guest joins us for a look at dangerous drinking, why it's such a problem in the state, and what it means for our health. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Wisconsin's drinking culture? Whether you've lived here all your life or you moved here from somewhere else, Do you notice different attitudes toward drinking and toward binge drinking in Wisconsin compared to other places? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Maureen Buzalaki is the director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's start with binge drinking. In 2019, about a third of Wisconsin adults reported binge drinking in the previous month, second highest in the nation after North Dakota at that time. Can you tell us more about that number and what we mean by binge drinking?
Sure. Binge drinking is 4 drinks in a 2-hour period for women and 5 drinks in a 2-hour period for men. And the reason why we say that is because then you're at 0.08. the legal limit. So I don't think folks necessarily understand, how alcohol affects them and how much. And excessive alcohol use not only includes binge drinking, mm-hmm. but also heavy drinking, which is considered 1 to 2 drinks a day, drinking while pregnant, and underage drinking. In terms of excessive alcohol use, every county in the state of Wisconsin has a higher rate of drinking than the national average. We're the only state where every county is above the national average.
Can you talk about some of the health consequences of our excessive drinking?
Yes, there's many. There's fully attributable deaths, including cardiomyopathy, liver disease, which I think a lot of us associate with fetal alcohol syndrome, and many others. And then there are acute deaths like alcohol poisoning, suicide, other kinds of injury-related deaths, with motor vehicle crashes, falls, suicide, homicide, firearms, aspiration, drowning, fire, hypothermia, and I could go on. And then chronic deaths associated with, partially attributable to alcohol, which is cancer for the mouth, throat, larynx, esophagus, larynx, breast, liver, and colon, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, pneumonia, and seizure disorders, to name a few.
I've had a lot of conversations over the years tackling the question, why Wisconsin? Why this focus on alcohol, particularly in Wisconsin? I've heard a lot of different answers floated and dismissed. What are some of your thoughts on that, Maureen?
Well, we have an interesting history. We weren't always like this. We had a number of leaders in the temperance movement. So we have kind of a varied history. In the last 20 years, we've seen Wisconsin policies change to allow alcohol in more and more places. In other places, it's not common to have alcohol in gas stations and certainly not cold or single serving, in gas stations. We find it at pretty much every event, it seems like. There's almost anything, even music festivals that are geared towards families and kids often will have alcohol with them. And then we are pretty liberal with our licensure. So we allow a lot of alcohol retail and bars and restaurants. And in other states, you've got like 1 alcohol license per 3,000 people in New Jersey or 1 to 1,500 in Idaho. In Wisconsin, the average is 1 for 354 people.
I want to get back to some of the consequences now, Maureen. And I think it may be hard to see this from within Wisconsin. When we stack up alcohol health consequences and compare them to the rest of the country, you mentioned that that county by county average, which is pretty striking. What are some of the other ways this shows up in Wisconsin's health consequences from alcohol being worse than the rest of the country?
So we have a very high number of liver transplants, in comparison to other states, based on our size. So that's certainly, and there's a number of healthcare consequences to the excessive alcohol use that we have in our state. So there's a number of injuries. We often think about motor vehicle injuries, but there's many others. We have very significant number of falls, every year that are attributable to alcohol.
you know, in the 500 range, which I think if you think about that, that's really high. And we lead the nation overall, as I understand it, in falls, you know, and so alcohol definitely contributes to that number.
We're talking about Wisconsin's drinking culture and the health consequences of our heavy drinking in the state. Maureen Buzalaki is with us, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at possible policy alternatives. You could join in. What do you think could be done to address high rates of binge drinking in Wisconsin, heavy drinking overall? What support do people struggling with alcoholism need? What are barriers to getting help? Are there changes you'd like to see related to alcohol in your own community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin, about why Wisconsin has among the highest rates of binge drinking in the nation, the health consequences of that, and what policy alternatives could be on the table. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think Wisconsin's culture affects alcohol consumption? Are there changes you'd like to see in state or maybe local law and regulations? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Maureen, let's get into public policy now. Are there changes that, say, other states have made that have helped them move in a better direction that maybe we could learn from here in Wisconsin?
Yes, for sure. The State Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse released a report on excessive alcohol and what policies could be helpful, and they named 61 recommendations. And so they range from things that can be done in civic organizations, for example. You know, if there's an organization hosting a fundraiser of some sort, perhaps not serving alcohol or, you know, being very limited in how much alcohol is being served to send a message, right, in terms of the culture and the community. Looking at local government, there's a number of things they can do with alcohol licensing, you know, to make sure that we don't exceed how many licenses that we want in a population, you know, looking maybe at around schools and thinking about, you know, how much do we want people to see as they're walking to school? You know, so there's a number of different kinds of things that they can think about. Now, you have to be careful with licensing to make sure that you're being, you know, even-handed and handling every license the same. But there are definitely things that can be done, especially with festivals, for example, you know, and making sure that if there's alcohol served, that it is in, as you know, a separate area, that people are being checked for the ID, and again, that they're not over-serving the patrons.
I think a lot of times when we talk about alcohol abuse, we look at individual solutions, whether that's, you know, a character flaw of the person, or we need to focus more on treatment, and treatment is important, of course. Do you think we pay enough attention to bigger picture, community and policy stuff?
We have communities all over the state that are making a lot of changes and, you know, really looking at the alcohol environment. But I would say overall, I think there's a lot more that we could do on the local level in terms of making sure that we have, you know, an understanding of how much alcohol is costing a community, you know, and how, you know, really looking at some of the data from law enforcement and understanding how many of those calls for service are alcohol related. And I think when people understand some of the costs, that can be helpful. The same can be true with, you know, health systems and understanding that, and then making decisions on, you know, how dense do we want alcohol outlets? We know there's violence associated with clustering of retail outlets, you know, liquor stores and those kinds of places. So really thinking ahead about, you know, what is it that we want for our community, and making some of those kinds of changes.
Let's bring on a caller. Patty is with us in Hayward. Patty, hello.
Hi. I just had a comment. I just recently moved to Wisconsin, and I'm definitely seeing, I'm retired. I just am definitely seeing like the drinking culture. Well, a few years ago, I was at a festival that was trying to raise money for this program I was involved in, and they were going to be serving alcohol. So I reluctantly agreed, but I'm kind of glad I did it because we had to have some training. And the police officer told me, or told us, that the people that were getting the most DUIs that he was seeing were men that were going off to work in the morning because they had been drinking in the evening, kind of had a high tolerance to it, but still were testing higher. So anyway, that really struck me because I know several people like this. And so I started carrying a breathalyzer around with me. And I don't know, that has seemed to make a difference to people because a lot of these guys are just stunned by how high they still are.
So you, I'm sorry, Patty, you breathalyze your friends and acquaintances? They go for that?
Yeah, why not? Why not? You know what? Because my son-in-law got a DUI for going 45 in a 35-mile-an-hour zone. And my daughter's like, Mom, he seemed okay. He was great. I'm like, well, until you see the numbers, you think you're okay, you know? So some people are just barely over. I had one drink the other day, and I was already at a 0.05 because I'm very small. So, yeah, bring it with me. I offer it because I think that the stats speak louder than words.
Patty, thanks a lot for the call. Maureen, Patty sees the difference here in Wisconsin. She's working to do something about it all by herself. What do you think?
Well, I think that's an interesting approach for sure. I know some places, you know, have those breathalyzers, you know, and I think part of it is that people need to know what a serving size is. So they might think they're having one drink, but they're actually having two. Or if it's, you know, there are Elko Pops, there are, we call them kind of a binge drink in a can. So it can be a large can of White Claw or Four Loko, for example, and they can contain 2 to 4 to 5 even drinks. And so your blood alcohol level can get very high very quickly while you're drinking that. So really paying attention to what is a serving size and really looking at how many you're having. And you know, the CDC has a campaign, be your best, you know, drink less, be your best.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking about Wisconsin's drinking culture and the health impacts of it, possible changes to fix it with Maureen Buzlaki with the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Maureen, I mentioned briefly a treatment earlier for people who recognize, hey, I'm drinking too much, whether it's binge or chronic drinking. I don't seem to be able to fix this myself. Do we have treatment out there for them when they need it?
I mean, there is treatment in many parts of the state, but I can't say universally that it's easily available. It kind of depends on where you are. We now look at it as an alcohol use disorder and that there are, you know, kind of a spectrum of that. And so trying to think about, you know, yourself and how you are with drinking and, you know, are you not having the relationship you want might be a good idea to talk to a healthcare provider. The CDC website also has, you know, kind of a quick quiz to help you also think about that because it's, you know, sometimes it's not that you have an alcohol use disorder, but that you're, you know, frequently binge drinking and, you know, you can get into a lot of trouble with that. And so it's important to try to work on that early. So if you think you're having, you know, an issue, you should probably talk to somebody very quickly. And I would always recommend healthcare as a first step.
In just our last minute or so, Maureen, now back in the day, I talked to you when you were with Smoke-Free Wisconsin. We've seen the number of smokers in the U.S. Drop by about half for over a 16-year or so period. Are there lessons from public health smoking campaigns that you think could apply to alcohol?
I do. I think there's a combination of really building public awareness, having strong policy, and really having kind of that cross-sector where you're working with public health, you're working with health systems, you know, law enforcement, Department of Transportation, and others.
Maureen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Been talking to Maureen Buzalaki, director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. She talked to us today about Wisconsin's high rates of binge drinking and other alcohol problems, the health consequences, possible policy solutions. Still time for you to share your story, your thoughts on this issue. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new report weighs the huge cost of invasive species around the world. Look at the massive price tag and check out invasive species here in the state. Our guest is a researcher who's focused on one particular species. We'll dig into that as well. And Ozempic and some of these other big-name drugs are starting to change the way we talk and think about weight loss. A Wisconsin expert on weight management joins the show to look at the roles of hormones, metabolism, these medications, and a whole lot more in determining our weight. You can get started right now with your experiences. Have you tried or thought about trying one of these new weight loss medications? Love to hear your story. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation, that and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a documentary filmmaker and medical expert answer questions about a common but often overlooked and underdiagnosed disease, endometriosis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.